We've told you the backstory here. We knew Carrie was leaving, and we said we've got to get our favorite guest on the show again before Carrie goes. He's right here through the magic of Skype, actor, author, storyteller Stephen Tobolowsky with us. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Rich. Good to talk to you. Good to see everybody in Maine again. Good to see the studio again. Oh,
I want to hold something up for you. This is good for the radio audience. If you can see this on camera, it's a picture of you here in the studio.
They're in the studio, and we were trying alcohol, weren't we? Weren't we drinking different kinds of alcohol?
We may have had some wine in here, I think.
I believe Eric had brought over a couple of samples for us.
We were sampling. This is what grown-ups do.
Science.
When they want to drink in places that they shouldn't drink, like in the radio studio, you call it sampling. You know, it's like we're going to do a wine tasting. That's a good one.
That's how we explained it to the FCC. Well, I know, congratulations are in order. You have added to the Tobolowsky family, right? A new grandchild, or relatively new?
We have a new grandbaby. Her name is Ember, E-M-B-E-R, Ember. And she, unlike Dior, who is like the Quisling child, Dior is like beautiful and amazing and mind-blowing. Ember is the happy child, laughing all the time. She's happy squeezing a ball. This is the easiest child in the world. So it's wonderful. I have another Diorism. I may have told you the one Diorism. The first Diorism was, this will tell you all about Dior, is she asked my son, Robert, her father, "Daddy, when you were what they call a baby, where was I?" That's the Diorism. So
wow.
Dior spent, yeah, think about that for a while. Dior spent the night this last week with me and Anne, which is rough on me and Anne, let me tell you. Lots of bath time, lots of story time. And Dior was worried about monsters in the house. And I told her that when we had our two boys, Robert and William, Anne and I went to each room and made all the monsters leave. Oh. So our house is actually monster proof. So I saw her in the morning for breakfast and I said, "How was your night?" And she shook her head, "Not good." "Why?" She goes, "The monsters. Dior, I told you I got rid of all the monsters." She said, "I know. I just haven't learned how to close my eyes."
Oh, man.
Wow. And I think about that every time here in Los Angeles, that you have to learn how to close your eyes, man. The monsters are everywhere.
So is there any better job out there than being a granddad?
No, nothing better. Nothing better at all. And again, it's all love and no responsibility. I had no idea being a grandfather would be so fantastic. I love it. I relish it. It is the greatest thing in my life. And for all you guys out there who are young and looking around, thinking, should I settle down? Should I get married? The answer is yes. Should I stay with the woman? The answer is, if possible, yes. And if there is a grandchild that comes from this union, eventually you will be the happiest guy in the world. There's nothing like it. Nothing like it.
We're talking with Stephen Tobolowsky here on Downtown. We want to steer clear, of course, and not have any SAG-AFTRA violations here. But I do want to talk, if we can, about what happened when you were filming a movie, a Hallmark movie, and your father had some medical issues, and you were telling me that the Hallmark people really stepped up.
It's really amazing. I was doing a movie for Hallmark this year. I've done two now. And I get a call from my brother saying, "Stephen, you've got to be able to come home to Dallas. I don't know if Dad is going to live through the week. You've got to be able to come home." And I was almost through with the Hallmark shoot. And I went to our producer and I said, "I have a problem." Because I was scheduled to finish the Hallmark shoot, fly back to Salt Lake, fly back to Burbank, whatever. I said, could you rearrange everything? And they did. A couple days later, I finished the shoot. They had a limo waiting for me that took me to the airport, that flew me to Dallas, that had a limo waiting for me that took me to my brother's house. We dealt with Dad, which, by the way, was a happy story. And Rich, I don't know if you do the same thing, but I always end up comparing things that happened in my life. And, you know, to make a simile of something that you're recognizing that you don't understand. The things Dad was going through was very much what I experienced when I finished my heart surgery and they put me on a pain medication that had morphine in it. And I was seeing things were moving around. I was just out of my mind. And they had put Dad on a morphine-based pain medication. And I talked to my brother, the doctor, and he said, well, this all looks like it could be drug-related. And Paul said, let's change the whole medical routine up of what Dad's getting. They took him off the morphine. They gave him a different kind of pain medication. And all of his symptoms went away.
Wow.
And by the time I left Dallas, Dad was sitting in his chair talking. He recognized everyone. Everything was back to normal. And the Hallmark people then got a limo and brought me from Dallas to the airport, flew me to Burbank, got a limo from Burbank to my home. So when times were tough, I was very happy that they helped me and accommodated me. That was above and beyond, I thought.
Well, that's wonderful. Also understand that you had an interesting shooting experience in Toronto.
It was weird. It was weird. So it's very weird. I was doing something for Netflix, which I loved. And I play this character and I'm not really sure who I am or what I am, because a lot of times when you shoot these streaming shows, they don't tell you what your background is or anything. But I shot this scene where I meet the lead of the show in an elevator. And we get in the elevator. We get out of the elevator. And he comes to my apartment. And then we have a 4-page scene. And he leaves. We shot that. And I went back to Los Angeles. And then they said, well, we need to bring you back to Toronto to finish the scene. And I go, what do you mean finish the scene? I only had one scene. We got on the elevator, we got off of the elevator, and we shot the scene. Yes, but we didn't shoot you in the elevator. I go, what? Yeah, you have to come back and we're going to shoot you in the elevator that doesn't move. It's a phony elevator. And this is what was amazing to me. When you see what happens in filming and TV, how amazing it was. It was enormously complex because we had already shot me getting on the elevator. So they had to find the same extras that they had before on the elevator, standing in the same place. But they had to shoot the elevator going up various floors. Of course, the elevator isn't an elevator. It's not moving. So what happens is the doors would close. The art department would run in, change the wallpaper, change the number on the door, change the rug. Then they had two guys opening the doors up. And it's like we're on a different floor. Then the elevator, some people get off, the elevator doctor, and the art department runs in, changes the door, the walls, everything, open it up. It's a whole different floor. And I'm like, oh my gosh. It was amazing. So that shoot took half a day of me going up in the elevator with various people getting off the elevator. So if your kids want to be an actor, steer clear. There's better ways to make a living. I promise you.
I mentioned this to you in an email that our regional theater here in Bangor, Penobscot Theater Company, celebrating their 50th season, and they're producing some plays that they have done in their past. And one of them, you know very well, a Pulitzer Prize winner, Crimes of the Heart. Can you talk a little bit about the process of what was going on in your world when that was being created?
Oh, my God. Crimes of the Heart. So, like, I don't know where to start the story, but I'll start like where my girlfriend was Beth Henley. Beth and I were together for about 16 years, from when she was a freshman in college to after she won the Pulitzer Prize for Crimes of the Heart. So we went to graduate school because Beth couldn't act, and she wanted to be an actress. No one would cast her. So we tried to find some place where we could at least get a graduate degree so we could teach and do nothing. So we go to the University of Illinois, and they have a playwriting class that has one girl student in it. And we went, and Beth and I did the reading of her play there, which was very good. It was very good. And on the walk home, Beth was saying, you know, Stephen, I think instead of being an actress, I want to be a playwright. And I go, okay, baby, you know, one of us could be a dental hygienist. You know, someone's going to have to bring in the money between me not working and you being a playwright. So an event happened in Beth's family afterwards where her grandfather got lost in the woods and Beth started writing furiously. It was a happy ending to grandfather's story as they finally found him after 3 days. He was fine. He wasn't injured. Beth and I get to Los Angeles, and she christened the little breakfast room as her writing area, and this is before the age of computers. So everything was typed, and you were fancy if you had an electric typewriter instead of the old manual. She had electric, so she's typing away. And she's typing a play that she's telling me is called Old Granddaddy's Dying. And I'm thinking like, okay, not a great title that make me want to come to the theater. Old Granddaddy's Dying. And so I wasn't taking this too seriously. And she ends up with this mound of paper on her desk. And I said, well, is it okay if I read Old Granddaddy's Dying? And she said, oh, please. So I start reading the pages off of the desk. Rich, this play was not just good. It was stratospheric. It was one of the greatest things I had ever read in my life. And I'm reading the pages while she's typing to get to the end of the play. And in a scene that would be in a Howard Hawks movie, like His Girl Friday, I'm getting to the end of the play as she pulls the last page out and hands it to me, and I burst into tears. And I'm going, Beth, this is one of the great plays I've ever read. This play will be in New York, I promise you. This play will be in New York, but you cannot have a play that's called Old Granddaddy's Dying. I mean, that. This play deserves a better title than that. So I said, why don't you call it, because one of the sisters in it shoots her husband because she doesn't like the way he looks, that the character, Babe. And so I said, why don't you call it Crimes of Passion? Because that's what it would be called in a legal court, like what Babe did as a crime of passion. So we had the play Crimes of Passion. And we were going to do it at our local theater, Equity Waiver.
And you were going to play Barnett, right?
I was going to play Barnett. Thurman Moss was going to play Doc. Sharon Ulrich was going to play Meg. Sharon Bunn was going to play Lynn. Beth was going to play Babe. We were going to do our Equity Waiver thing and make this play come to life. Well, Sharon Ulrich, unknown to any of us, gave the play, Crimes of Passion, to her agent, who didn't read it. But he kept a pile of plays for a friend of his who, when he came out from New York, he liked to read plays. So he gave a pile of plays to this man, whose name happened to be Gilbert. Gilbert flies back to New York, and we get a phone call from Kennedy Airport from Gilbert Parker. I answer the phone. He says, could I please speak to Beth Henley? Is she there? Is she at this number? Yes, I give the phone to Beth. And the look on Beth's face is like, while she's listening to this man talk, Gilbert Parker, the man who happened to pick this play to be the first play he read on the way to New York, was one of the leading literary agents in New York. He handled Lillian Hellman, Mark Medoff. He worked with Tennessee Williams. This was one of the biggest guys in the world. And he says, I would like to help you with your play. He says, but it can't have the name Crimes of Passion, because Ken Russell is about to do a movie called Crimes of Passion. And even though you can't copyright a title, you should have a different title. So Beth hung up, amazed that this man was going to help her with the play, this man she from out of the blue. And she said, sweetie, I need another name for the play. And I said, well, if you're not going to name it Crimes of Passion, why don't you call it Crimes of the Heart? Because that's kind of the same kind of thing. So I claim, at least I saved the world from old granddaddy's dying. And that play went on to win the best play at the Louisville Play Festival, Actors Theater of Louisville Festival. I ended up playing Barnett in St. Louis. The play played in Los Gatos. It had a few regional productions, and somebody wanted to bring it off Broadway. And it ended up over at the Manhattan Theater Club. And was it Melvin Bernhardt, I believe, directed it in New York, and ended up winning the Pulitzer Prize. And Beth ends up nominated for a Tony Award. Then they're going to make a multi-million-dollar movie of it. She gets nominated for an Academy Award, and her life just exploded, and everything changed. And it is fantastic. If you haven't seen Crimes of the Heart, you must go to the theater and see it. It's absolutely wonderful, and so many parts of it are true. So many parts of the play are true, which is amazing. And it's one of the great plays. I think they have it now in an anthology of great plays of the last few decades, which it is. It is spectacular.
But if I remember right from your book, too, and I think the podcast, the success of the play and everything that happened also sent the two of you in opposite directions.
Rich, why do you have to bring that up?
We'll move on. We can change topics now.
So anyway, when you win the Pulitzer Prize, I think Beth won $10,000. I think she won $10,000, something like that. She won $1,000 for Louisville. It wasn't a princely amount, but she bought a Volkswagen, a Bug, which she wanted, and a washer dryer, which we needed. So there was all that, and we celebrated. We celebrated for about a month. And then when all of this success came in, Beth had not only an agent, but many agents, and not only advisors, many advisors, some of them financial advisors. And what we always did before is Beth and I kind of, when we were together, we split everything. So I would pay the rent, she would pay the utilities, because I had a job. I did children's theater in the schools in Los Angeles, and Beth ended up getting a little job, a temporary job, working in a dog food company. So, you know, it wasn't princely. We were used to this life for 10 years where, you know, we just split everything. But once Beth won the Pulitzer, and once she gets the play goes to New York, all of the agents and all the managers kind of, you know, so she needs an investment. She needs a new house. So the house is going to be up in the Hollywood Hills. So she ends up with the house, swimming pools, and movie stars. And whenever, you know, Beth had to go on the road with the play, I had to take care of the house. You know, so I kind of became the yard boy. I had to be there to make sure the gardener got in and out and all this kind of stuff. And it sort of interfered with me having an acting career at all. And so it was either I had a career either directing or acting in Beth's plays, or I had nothing. And that was difficult for me. And it was difficult for her because she was traveling all the time everywhere. And she felt like the world was her oyster, and maybe she didn't need to be with her college boyfriend. And so that caused problem that caused us difficulty. I think one of my favorite stories. We have time for one of my favorite stories from this period.
Of course, we do.
So Beth and I broke up, and it was quick. It was very quick. It just happened one day, and I realized the situation was impossible for me. She really wasn't in a mood to stop me, you know, and I said, I'm moving out. I got all my stuff, and I moved out of the house, and I took all the money I had and rented a house about four blocks away. So I was still in the same neighborhood renting a house. And as soon as I moved out, I got a call from my agent. Alan Parker wants you to read for the part of the head of the Ku Klux Klan, Mississippi Burning. So I'm thinking like, well, this is psychic. As soon as I leave the house, my career starts again. And so but I'm very depressed because I broke up with Beth. I feel like I'm dead, really. My heart, soul, and mind. I'm in so much pain. I never had so much psychic pain in my life. So I go in and I read for the head of the Ku Klux Klan, just staring out the window. I love Mississippi. They hate Mississippi. And I just do the speech. I get a call back. I go back a week later, same speech, same depression, looking out the window. And I get a third call back a week later. Now I'm getting scared. You know, now the depression has gone down and the anxiety over getting this part. Three callbacks is serious. Now I'm in the office with real actors who I'd be competing against, like Gary Sinise and people. I mean, really good people. And the secretary leaned out of her desk when I'm sitting there very nervous, feeling like I'm going to choke. And she said, Mr. Tobolowsky, I just wanted to tell you, Alan Parker likes you very much. He says everyone has tried to come into the office and be scary in this role, but you are scary naturally. So, right. She gave me heart. So I went in and had a good third audition. Then I get a fourth audition. But Rich, the fourth audition was going to be in Jackson, Mississippi, Beth Henley's hometown.
Whoa.
Jackson, wow. Mississippi. Now we had been apart for 6 weeks, and I'm thinking, oh my God, what if Beth actually flew back to Mississippi? What if she's there in Jackson now when I'm there? What if worlds collide? Now I'm staying at the Holiday Inn in Jackson, Mississippi, and it is the day of my audition. I think my audition was about 1 o'clock in the afternoon, and it was that morning I thought, what if I stalk Beth? What if I stalk her? That's a good idea. I could rent a car. No one would recognize. I know where her house is. I could see if she's living there. So I drive over to Beth's house the morning of my audition. I park in front of her house, and there through her window, I see her sister walking in the dining room and says, oh, no, no, it's Lynn. Oh, God, no. Oh, God, no, Cece, don't recognize me. And I'm scouching down. Oh, God, if Beth is, oh, this is evil, Stephen. You can't do this, Stephen. This is not good for your head. Drive back to the Holiday Inn. Drive back. So I drove back. I calmed down. I walk into my audition, which is with Alan Parker in a hotel room. So he has a little, the room is all dark except for a light in the corner where he wants me to sit. He has his camera set up. I sit down and he goes, so, Stephen, I just had dinner with your ex last night. She happens to be in Jackson, Mississippi. And we went out to dinner, and I have a question for you. Why did you two break up? And I said, Alan, we broke up because we had a big disagreement as to what constituted a joke. And he goes, very good, very good. Let's do the scene. So I did the Ku Klux Klan wow. scene. And on my way, walking to my little hotel room in the Holiday Inn, my phone is ringing. It's my agent in California. You have the part.
Wow.
And so there was something psychically tied to the beginning of my film career and Beth and I breaking up. And we hadn't talked to each other for many, many, many years, Rich, until I wrote Dangerous Animals Club. Mm. I wrote Dangerous Animals Club, and Anne, my wife, said, Stephen, you have to call Beth. You have to tell her you're writing these stories and she's in your book. You have to tell her. God bless Anne. She's fearsome. It's always good to marry someone who's fearsome. So I call Beth up, and Beth tells me she's going to sue me. And I said, well, I said, I could save you money on the lawyer because you have to prove three things for a lawsuit. One, you have to prove that I said a falsehood, which I didn't. You have to say that I said something negative about you, which I didn't. And you have to prove that I caused harm, injury in terms of physical injury, not physical, but money, that I harmed you financially. And I have emails from people telling me that they had never heard of Crimes of the Heart. And now that they read my book, they're all going to read it. So I actually can have helped. So anyway, Beth and I had lunch at that point in time, and we didn't really talk about anything. I think she was playing it close to the vest. And I think the last time we spoke, out of the blue, I had finished doing an episode of One Day at a Time. And I'm driving home that night after a shoot, and my phone rings on the way home, Beth Henley. And I went, oh my God. And Beth calls me up on the phone, and she said, how did you get to be you? And I said, part of the way I got to be me was you. We both learned a lot when we were together. We both went through a lot when we were together. And that's how any of us learn to be who we are, is we kind of ingest the good and the bad. And if it doesn't kill us, what is it? It makes us, well, I don't know if it makes us strongest, but it does make us weirder. And so we're able to survive. We're able to survive that. But that was the last time I talked about it. But for you folks in Maine, you got to go see Crimes of the Heart. You won't regret that.
And the best part of the story is that you and Anne have been married for what, 35 years now?
Something like that, 35 years. And I learned something, which I'll pass on to the younger members of your audience. A lot of people think the key to marriage is the bedroom. It's not. It's the emergency room. You need to be married to someone who can help protect and navigate you when you are injured, when you are ill, when you are in trouble. When I had a broken neck, I had Anne Hearn taking care of me. And she just did about everything you could do. I mean, she bathed me in the shower. She helped me walk. She helped me eat. And when I had my open heart surgery, I had Anne Hearn in my corner. And when I had an accident with the pee bottle in my bed, and I kept pressing for the nurses to come, and nobody came. So I pressed the red button on my little thing, which means I'm dying of a heart attack. You must come. And they still didn't come until 20 minutes later. And the Russian nurse comes in and says, what is wrong? I said, I had a problem with the pee bottle in the bed. She says, you have misused the blue button. You misuse it. I said, yeah, but can you help me? Anne Hearn came in and read everybody on that hospital floor the Riot Act. She came in and said, this is not going to happen again. I am get a bed in this room. I am going to stay here with my husband. And from now on, you take orders from me. That is what you need to marry.
You're absolutely right. I when I had my my surgery, my wife Loretta learned how to do wound dressings because my foot surgery. It needed to be dressed twice a day, every single day. And my daughter had a little bit of a nursing background, so she helped Loretta to learn, and Loretta did that Not for a little while. That was like a 3-month process. I think after the first month, it went to once a day, but she learned how to do it. And it's a big reason why I was back to a full recovery in 6 months, which none of the doctors or the specialists thought would be the case. They said, you know, you'll be approaching normal in 6 months, but it'll be a good year before you're back to normal. And yeah, that is a true test of a relationship.
Yeah. The emergency room, guys, the emergency room, that's who you need. You need someone to protect you when you're flat on your back mm-hmm. in the street or with, when you mentioned the wound thing, Carrie, that wound stuff is so serious. That happened to my brother's wife, and I had no idea. It was such a risky, horrible thing. Mm. I'm so glad you came out of that in one piece, and bless your wife for helping you. My God, that isn't an easy job or a good job, but boy, you had someone in your corner.
Yes, absolutely, and that's why I am still in one piece, is because of her.
Yeah, and leaving. And one piece and leaving for New Orleans.
And now he's taking her to New Orleans, yeah. And I'm the one left behind, Stephen. Well, Stephen, it's wonderful to catch up with you, as always. Appreciate you coming on one more time while Carrie's still here in studio with us.
Yes, Carrie, I give you my love. I will miss having those wine appreciation and tastings in the studio. I appreciate that greatly. And I know you're going to have a wonderful time in New Orleans. Just bring bug spray.
Yes.
I will need bug spray.
I'll be sure to bring along the off that is an essential here in Maine as well.
Essential. Yes. Put those little strips outside and catch those bugs before they get in.
And we might be able to find a place to have a wine tasting or two if you ever make it down to Louisiana as well. So
I look forward to that. I do.
Stephen, thank you so much. Fingers crossed that the strike gets settled fairly soon in a fair and just way for all of the actors and the writers.
Yes, absolutely. I heard the acting strike could be over before the writer's strike, but, you know, we're nothing without the writers. So we'll see what happens.
Absolutely. Well, good to talk with you. Our best as well to Dior and Ember, and we'll talk with you again down the road.
You got it, Rich. My pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you, Stephen. Stephen Tobolowsky with us here on Downtown.